Introduce our main speaker for this evening, Jane from Chula Vista.
I'm Jane, I'm an alcoholic. See if I can break the microphone right off, that'll help. I'm glad to be here. I'm always glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill said it was a light crowd tonight, and I said, good. Happy to know that. I have been to this meeting before, and I've been sober 42 years. So, yeah, no one's more surprised than me that Alcoholics Anonymous works, you know, and when welcome to the newcomers, and congratulations, Kevin. That's a big deal. It is a big deal. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not, you know, like most of us, not really that happy to be here. And people wanted to hug me, and I did not like people. I didn't want people to look at me. And I didn't really know there was anything wrong with me. And I want you to know it took me a long time before I got alcoholism. I didn't understand, you know, really what we're all here for in the first place. And I didn't know really how bad off I was until I had been here a while. And it took a long time. So if you're new and you don't know if you're an alcoholic, keep coming back, because a really wise person asked me, you know, what makes you think you're an alcoholic? And, of course, I heard, you're not an alcoholic. That's what I thought she was saying to me. That's not what she was saying to me at all, because I don't hear that well. I don't know about you, but I don't hear. I hear things I want to hear instead of what you're actually saying to me. And so I did not know what alcoholism is. I know today that there was a lot wrong with me before I ever took a drink. And I've heard a lot of stories here in my 42 years, and they're all different, and people drink differently. They become alcoholic at different times in their lifespan. They engage in different activities. Some are successful and some are not successful, and some are great drinkers and are able to kind of cruise through, and kind of like a Mr. Magoo, if you know who that cartoon character is, you know, just able to stumble through life and not pay any consequences. And there are a few that, you know, just no matter what, they get caught and pay severe consequences. But I know for myself, I believe that I was born alcoholic and was just waiting for my first drink. And I want you to know that when I did take my first drink, it was, you know, kind of a normal story that I heard 100 times, where my brothers saved some beers from someone's Holy Communion party, and we waited till the parents went to bed and drank those beers. And I should tell you what kind of a kid I was, and I was always selfish and self-centered and self-consumed. I couldn't think of anything but me. And I had justification for that. I was really skinny, and I had buck teeth, and I had thick glasses that were always broken, and I have 5 cowlicks in my hair, and if it's not a certain length, it does what it wants to do in different directions. And my mother always insisted on cutting it short, so it always was, I always looked surprised. And I was really, really skinny, and I was one of those kids, I know you've seen them, I was so skinny that my socks would slide down in my shoes because my ankles were too narrow to hold up the socks. And then I had a cousin who was really overweight, and she was 5 years older than me, and my mother always insisted on getting her clothes to give to me to wear. So I was a mess. I was truly a mess. So I felt odd, and I looked odd. And my parents would introduce me to people, and they'd go, I could just tell by their faces, what a cute little girl. You know, inside I'd be like, I knew they were lying. But so anyway, I felt odd and I looked odd and I was odd. I just want you to know that I was mentally, you know, not hitting on all cylinders. I have three brothers and a sister, and we lived two blocks from school, and I was so self-conscious about where we lived and who my family members were. I would run home from school, I'd go to my last class, and I'd take my coat with me. We lived in Chicago, so you needed your coat to get home, but I'd grab my coat and run home as if no one was going to ever find me. And I just wanted to get home before anyone could see which house I went into. And my brothers and their friends would come over and just ruin the whole thing, you know, just ruin my whole idea of, I think I'm getting away with it this time. So I really did have, you know, huge problems. So that first time I drank, I want you to know that I felt great. I no longer cared what I looked like. I thought I looked great. And I didn't care what you thought of me, and I didn't care what I thought of you. I, for the first time in my life, I felt free. And I wanted to feel that way forever. I never wanted that feeling to end. And I sought to get to that same feeling, return to that, every time I drank again. And I could never quite get to the sufficient magnitude that I had first experienced. But I gave it my all. I want you to know I did not I did not give up trying to secure that feeling once again. And I'm the kind of person that it's just never enough for me. When I would drink, I always had to have drugs too. And because my motto was, you know what would make this just a little bit better? I always had that, you know, what could just increase this? It's just never going to be enough. I'm never going to be enough. And I always wanted more. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got here through a coworker. I had seen the Days of Wine and Roses, and I really didn't know much about, you know, I didn't identify readily with that movie because it's so dark, you know. And let's face it, that they do not make meetings look attractive, you know. It's just so dismal and it's kind of like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know. Yeah. So, well, and there are meetings that are like that, don't get me wrong. I've been to some, but I went and this coworker invited me to his home for, he quit the job, and a couple days after his last day, he had invited me over for a barbecue, and at the end of the barbecue, after we were done eating, he said, we're going to go to an AA meeting, so you can either wait here for us or go with us. And so I went to the meeting, and I thought he was trying to get me a date. So I should describe what I look like so that you know, I can verify that when I said I wasn't right when I got here, even before I drank, I didn't have hair in the front of my head. I weighed about 95 pounds. I had acne all over my body, and I didn't know that I looked bad. I just, you know, I thought, you know, someone's trying to get me a date. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, the odds are good that the goods are odd. And I could get a date looking like I looked. Miracle? I don't know. Oh, God. So it's a strange world we live in. But, you know, I lived through that and got to my first meeting. And I can't remember really what people said, but I remember looking around the room and thinking, you know, I think I kind of expected people to have like little horns on the top of their head or something, some identifying mark that made them an alcoholic, and they just talked about things, and I remember being so embarrassed for them because they were talking about emotions, And I did not have emotions. You know, I didn't readily emote. I was pretty much a flatline depressive and had to deal a lot with depression in my sobriety. But I would remember listening to people talking about how they felt. And it was just like, oh, I just can't take it. I wanted to get up and run out of myself, you know, because it was so, it was just too much for me. But at the same time, I felt peaceful being there. I didn't feel like anyone was going to throw me out. I didn't get to talk. No one asked me to talk. I did go to start going to meetings, but I too went to Al-Anon, and you know, I really did not identify with Al-Anons at all, and I found them kind of boring. But don't tell anyone, but but I did, and you know, it was just that I was in the wrong room. I was just in the wrong room, and you know, by the grace of God, I finally got to a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now that didn't, I make that sound like, and then, you know, I saw the light. I got to tell you, I was listening to the third chapter being read tonight, and I kind of smiled, because when I first heard that, I thought, well, that is a ridiculous list of things to do. That is just crazy. And I want you to know that when I read the part about the jaywalker in the book, I just thought that was the most ridiculous thing I have ever seen. Who would do that? And I was doing all those things and could not see. So thank you for mentioning our second step. I don't think there's anything more incredible than our strange mental blank spot. You know, of course, I didn't have one when I got here. I could see yours, but I did not have a strange mental blank spot when I got here. So this is a crushing blow for me to recognize that I'm an alcoholic. You know, I grew up in a family where there was always alcohol there. There was just never any time that there was not a full refrigerator of beer and that everyone was drinking. We had exciting relatives. My mother would have her family over for the holidays, and it would always be the same pattern. We'd start, and they'd party, and they'd drink, and the police would be called, and half my family are the police, and so always awkward. So the party would end with some disruptive behavior. Somebody would get hurt and physically beaten, and then they would swear off forever. We're never going to talk to them again, and they wouldn't until the next holiday was approaching, and then they would kiss and make up and make plans for the next literally big bash to happen. You know, so that was just the recurring thing in life. But I did not know that alcohol was a problem that was in that equation. I really didn't. I got married for the first time when I was 17. I had parents that were not really attentive and not really into being parents. They had too many children too fast that they couldn't afford, and I took over and was the second oldest and kind of took charge of the house, and ended up meeting a man that was 22. I married him when I was 17, but I met him when I was 15. So he was 20 and I was 15 when we met. And then 22 years later, we got married. But I only married him because I wanted to get out of the house. And I really was striving to be somewhere where no one was going to tell me what to do anymore. That was my goal in life. I want to get somewhere where no one's going to tell me what to do. And, you know, I don't think that's unreasonable at 15 to expect to have get someplace where you aren't, no one's going to tell me what to do anymore. But, you know, that didn't work out. I wasn't married for 2 weeks before he started telling me what to do. And, you know, he was alcoholic also, and I didn't know that for years. I really didn't. And he had a long list of problems, and you know, so did I. But you know, I almost died this. Well, I almost died several times, but this one night I was at a party, and I, you know, I would take anything that anyone offered me. You know, I was already drunk, and somebody said, "Oh, do you want some mescaline?" And I said, "I don't even know what mescaline is, you know, but sure, I do, because it's free." My first, you know, question is it free? So anyway, I snorted it, and it turned out to be PCP. You know, my ex, he wasn't my ex yet, but, you know, it's one of those things where I snorted it and then knew immediately, uh-oh, this is not good. And grabbed his arm, and I just know I had this look of terror in my eyes. And I remember him looking at me like, "Oh, my God, not again." And so he and this other guy were dragging me upstairs. The people whose home we were having the party at happened to be moving that day, so the house was pretty much empty. So they were going to drag me up the stairs and just leave me. They weren't going to call for help. They weren't going to get me anywhere to get help. And I remember I could hear them, and I could hear the plan, but I couldn't speak, and I couldn't move to make any act in my own defense or speak and say, I'm still breathing. but I'll never forget that feeling of, you know, I'm just going to be abandoned here. And they did abandon me, and I was laying there, and I remember thinking, I heard this voice, and it said, "You can die right now, or you can live. You have to know the choice is yours. You have a responsibility for that." And I had to think about it. I didn't know if, you know, I wanted to get up and live. You know, I didn't know what that was like. And I remember just going out, and the next thing I knew, I was throwing up. And my relationship with that guy was just never the same. It was, you know, truly, it really it changed everything, and I felt like I had changed totally inside. But I had no solution. I had no way to know, you know, where am I going to go from here? How do I get out of this? So I couldn't, you know, I was still doomed to continue in drinking and using. So it was really a couple years later, I said prayers. I wanted, you know, God to help me find friends. I didn't know that there was treatment in, you know, treatment facilities. And this is in 1975, 77, somewhere in there. And I didn't know that there was, I didn't know I had a disease, let alone get treatment for it. So it took a long time for me to finally get help. I really wasn't that willing. I really did not know that giving up alcohol would be the right thing to do. I really had to think about, I don't know if this is going to be worth it or not. I really didn't. So I was totally insane. And so sitting in meetings, listening to people, I did not have feelings right away. I remember people would offer me the four-step guide. You know, I think back now, four-step. I haven't taken the first three steps, and they want me to, you know, think about the four-step. And, you know, I know that people always try to be so helpful here, and that was really awful for me. to help me. So I remember looking at the four-step guide someone gave me, and it said, list the people and principles and institutions at which you were angry or resentful. And I didn't have anything to put down on the paper. I really did not know what those words meant, you know, but I wasn't going to ask anyone either. And what I know today is I had lived my life under an anesthetic, and the anesthetic had not yet worn off. It takes sobriety and being here for a little while before the anesthetic wears off, and it's the impression of, oh my God, I am insane, came over me. That's, I am just crazy. And people would always try to help me. They'd say, you know, Jane, insane people don't know they're insane. And I'd think, why do they keep saying that to me? I just thought I was fine. And I really did think, all I need to do is stop drinking and everything's going to be great. I'm just going to be the princess I know I am and the wonderful person I know I am. And, you know, how hard can this thing be, really? So it took a long time, and I want you to know that I had several inventories. I picked a woman who had just been released from the mental institution. She had 14 years of sobriety and had a, you know, what we'd call a nervous breakdown, and she had to go as inpatient in the mental ward for a little while. But I thought she'd make a great sponsor. And so that's who I picked as my first sponsor, was that woman. And she did help me. She helped me a great deal. But I could tell she was like, didn't have a lot of energy to help me. She was really struggling with her own depression and her own grief. And she'd had some problems in her marriage. But, you know, she still took time with me. And I wrote the normal first fourth step, which is a sad, sad biography. Oh, woe is me. You won't believe what happened to me. And I was not able, and I need a lot of help with inventory in getting to the find my part in it. You know, I really did not have a lot of ownership of my own character defects. I didn't know what a character defect was. And It took a long time before, and I want you to know, repetition at the steps. So I could do step one and then start to do step two, sort of, kind of, and until my fear of being labeled insane hit me, and then I'd have to back off, and then I could get more comfortable being insane, and then start into step three, and then move sort of to step four. And I had to keep moving through that and got better at each one the more runs I took at it. And, you know, the inventory process today saved my life. You know, it really did. To be able to, you know, our first principle in the step is honesty, and I had not been able to be honest. So I love chapter 5 today, you know, where we talk about those that are constitutionally incapable of being honest. I was one of those people. I am constitutionally incapable of being honest about my character defects, about my fears, about my beliefs. I'm not willing to look at, you know, how these beliefs, these stories that I've told myself about the world and about how it should be and demand that it should be, how that stuff gets me into trouble. It took me a long time and a lot of runs at that. And I've had only a few sponsors, but I got to tell you, the last sponsor I had, she died of Alzheimer's, but that woman spent a lot of time with me and really mothered me. You know, I did not have a good mother, and it took many years for me to realize I did not have good parenting. You know, I thought that was the reason why I was alcoholic, but the real reason I'm alcoholic is that's my chemistry. You know, I was born with that chemistry, and that's the way it is. And the rest of the stuff just happens to be there, because I've heard your stories, and your stories are all very different from mine. But I so appreciated her, you know, things that went on in my home. I eventually had to separate from my family. There was many years where I did not have contact with my parents. And And I want you to know that I still made amends to them, but I never was able to reconnect with them because I could never do that without reconnecting to the abuse that went on in our home. And it was, I had to get outside help in order to get to that point to be able to make that determination to cut those ties. And that was many, many years ago. And the reason I'm talking about that tonight is because my mother did pass away. It'll be a year next month that she passed away. And my father had passed away several years before her. But she disinherited 3 of her 5 children from her will. And I'm not talking, you know, the Rockefeller estate or anything, but otherwise I really would be crying. Now that'd be something to work through. She disinherited 3 of the 5 kids, of which I'm one, but so it wasn't. Oh God, you'd have to, you know, you don't have enough time for the whole story, but and the details of that aren't important. I'm just trying to hit the importance of amends here, and I had to take great care and got great guidance in making amends. And I want you to know, really, the last great amends I made to my mother was probably 10 years ago. And I wrote this letter to her because I wanted to change how I reacted every time I thought of her or our family. I didn't want to feel the way I felt inside. And I realized I'm carrying that out in the world with me. And thank God that the fourth step really gave me the ability to understand that I have developed a belief system. So when our 12 and 12 talks about instincts gone awry, it's normal and natural that I would expect and want to be connected to and need to be connected to a family. But the fact is that family wasn't there and wasn't good to be connected to. So all that set aside, I had to write my mother a letter, and I thanked her for all the good things that she had given me. All the good things she had given me. And she never responded, but I know she read it because my brother, who has to tell everything on everybody, y'all have one, I know, called me to tell me that, you know, she was really mad about the letter that she had gotten. But you know what? It changed everything for me. I really had peace in my heart. And when she passed, I still have peace in my heart that about our relationship. You know, it wasn't because of anything that I had neglected or any stone I had not failed to overturn in order to look at me and to ask for a higher power's help. So don't skip any part of these amends. And for me, you know, I keep making them. I owe a great debt to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've gotten into service, and somebody was joking with me about the really nerdy stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I am one of those nerds. I served for a long time in the area. I was able to serve as delegate to this area, to the General Service Conference. And then I started a meeting a couple years ago, and we discuss how, in principle, each step is related to its corresponding tradition and concept. So we talk about the spiritual principles. It's based on, you know, that we practice these principles in all our affairs. And so this is coming from somebody who was sitting in my early meetings, and people would say, and then I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd sit there and think, what is the message? What is your message here? I could not hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. But so today I've got this meeting about we practice these principles in all our affairs, and knowing that these spiritual principles that are in our steps are intertwined in our traditions and in the concepts for world service. And so there are other nerds like me that come to the meeting, and we get to talk about practicing these principles in all our affairs. And I just absolutely love it. We get people who are also in service and are new to service, have never... we have a brand newcomer. He had like a month of sobriety, and he comes to this meeting, and he's just like totally lost. And he's sitting there, and he's like, this is really cool stuff. And I'm so grateful that he could see it, because it is really cool stuff. I mean, it's our traditions and our concepts, when you get into how they're written and how they're formed, they're sheer genius. They really are. But, you know, I won't bore you with those details. But the incredible experience of representing our area, and to see Alcoholics Anonymous at work is truly awesome. So, you know, the principle of step 12 and tradition 12 and concept 12 is service. That's what that spiritual principle is. And service existed before the steps even existed. That's how Bill got started, was going down alleys and into bars and grabbing drunks and taking them to the Oxford group. You know, that was his service. And it was tolerated by the Oxford group because their spiritual principle was to do service. And that's how that continued. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous just happened to be written because Bill wanted an income stream. He needed to get an income stream. And the steps weren't written until they got to chapter 5. So the steps didn't even exist until they started writing the book, which didn't happen for a few years after Bob and Bill had been sober. So it was truly a miracle that that got written, you know, and that it still stands today. So and the traditions are just as much a miracle. And I really was one of those that thought, well, that's for everybody else. That's really not for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's for you to do. And everybody would say, you know, yeah, the steps are for the individual and the traditions are for the group. And I didn't realize that I was a member of a group. I didn't want to be a member of a group, to tell you the truth. I don't like responsibility, and I didn't want to be responsible. So it's not an easy, you know, I don't know how I got from don't touch me, don't look at me, don't talk to me, to, you know, this is so incredible. This stuff is really incredible. So, you know, I urge you to, you know, take a crack at it. Take a crack at service. There's no way to explain the concepts or our traditions unless I take action. They're an experience. They're not something that, you know, these banners and these words, just like the steps. And if you've worked the steps and you've experienced the miracle of the steps, you know that the words on this sheet up here don't give it enough emphasis, enough depth to what the experience is. You have to live it. So the traditions are the same way. And it's amazing. It's been an amazing journey. You know, today I sponsor a lot of people. I just was contacted by somebody who I lost touch with. I used to live in Long Beach. I lived there for 20 years of my sobriety, and moved down here in 2000, 2001, somewhere like that, and lost track of a few people. And somebody just contacted me that I used to sponsor her, and you know, she's doing really well. She's been sober 35 years now. And, you know, I have lots of lots of women in my age group of sobriety. And, you know, that is such a wonderful thing to, that is my family. So I have women that I have known all my sobriety that I'm still in touch with. And thank God for cell phones and the, you know, people have moved away, but there's no long distance charges anymore. You can just text or pick up the phone and call, and they're all right there. It's an incredible world to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to go up north, and I've spoken at some of their meetings up there, and they have some very huge service meetings, and I've been able to go up there and share the message of service, and I really got like the service because when I told you about the I need more, I want you to know that that has not changed for me in sobriety. I still need more. I still need more of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've not grown tired of it. I've not gotten enough of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really been an incredible journey to be here and to keep going. So somebody was asking me, you know, since I've rotated out of the area service, what am I doing? And I'm doing even more nerdy stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if any of you have seen the service manual. Anybody here know what the service manual is? CARE? So the AA World Services, the publishing company that publishes the big book, they also published the service manual. They're rewriting it, thank God. They reorganized it to appeal to the general service representative, to talk to the general service representative. So we're into our 70th conference. We're going to have 70th conference this year, and they're finally realizing that the GSR doesn't have enough information to know what he or she is doing. So they're decided to reorganize the service manual. And I was one of the people that got selected to review the draft, and I wrote 29 pages of what's wrong with it. So you're welcome. But I want you to know that was not something I thought I would be doing when I first arrived here and first was able to. Are you timing me?
Yeah. You're not there yet.
Oh, I'm not. Oh, man. Okay, well, I may be because, you know, I'm surprised I've been able to go this long because I got to tell you, I've been to the podium and talked for 20 minutes and gone, that's it, sorry. So my drinking career was not really that long, you know. It was really, you know, 5-6 years. But, you know, I zoomed right through it. I think I had a PhD in it by the time. Some of you were just not as dedicated, I feel, as I was. So anyway, I hope that you gotten something, you know, out of what I've said tonight. And you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, we are an odd bunch of people. You know, when you think about all the stories and all the walks of life we come from, and all the insane things we do. I mean, I've heard some insane stories of people who have done things sober. You know, just in their sobriety, you know. So, again, back to our second step, there is no relief from alcoholism, and I've seen it. And the stories that I've watched unfold before me have been absolutely incredible. So there was a guy, when I was first new, he'd say, I want you to stay sober until you watch the guy next to you drink. And see what happens to that guy. And I want you to know I've stayed here and watched that guy drink a lot. Some don't come back. You know, I've seen people after 30 years take a drink, and I've seen them die. I've had sponsees that have died on me. I was thinking one of the times I've been in this room, there was a young man that I talked to, and he struggled, and he killed himself. You know, so, you know, this is life or death, and you don't know. When we come to a meeting, I don't know if I'm talking to somebody to save their life or not. You know, people suffer here. When we talk about the alcoholic who still suffers, sometimes they're suffering right in our rooms. You know, so this is a deadly disease, and there's a lot of work to be done. I love when people argue about mental illness and talk about a strange mental blank spot. We can't see that. I could not see that alcoholism is a mental illness. You know, nobody would do to themselves what I've done to myself with alcohol if I wasn't in fact ill. So I've got 5 minutes, but you know, I'm done. Thank you.